I'm Christopher Lydon with a most unusually penetrating commentator on this age of Obama, on Barack Obama himself, on the ups and downs that all sorts of citizens of the U.S. and the world can feel 2 years into this journey. David Brumwich is not a White House reporter or a political scientist. He's the Sterling Professor of English at Yale. He reads Barack Obama closer than anybody else I know through his words. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. David Brumwich, the question really is about how language reveals the man and how you personally dope it out.
I do it just as a reader and as a citizen and trying to listen closely to what the assertions are and what the attempt at persuasion that you get from this or that politician seems to add up to. In Obama's case, he is an unusually glamorous, and he's been well treated by the media so as to heighten his glamour. An unusually forceful politician, more forceful, I think, from a distance, as we began by seeing him. And one who's very concentrated on the task of rhetorical persuasion as he understands it, and who raised expectations about his own performance and his presidency, I think, by offering himself, even describing himself early, as an author, as somebody who would have liked to be a writer. So he has these two books. Everyone who's looked into them or read them agrees that the first is the more interesting of the two. And I would say that only the first, the one called Dreams from My Father, has much individual about it of verbal performance. But then, you know, there are the speeches he made starting in his Democratic Convention speech in 2004, where he was offered up to the country as the great new face of the Democratic Party. And he asked us to believe that we were not two countries, but one country. We were not red states and blue states, but all one America. I think the reception of his own presidency has proved that he was wrong about that. We are red states and blue states. We can hope to come together again, but he greatly underrated the difficulty of the task. And I think he characteristically overrates the potency of words and of his words. But like others, I began to see this tendency in him only after he was president, really. I was not very wary of it. I was, for 15 months or so, very enthusiastic about Obama. I thought he could win. I thought he should win. And I had high hopes for the presidency.
In the London Review of Books, David Brumwich, where I read you, you're also reading not just the texts, but even quasi-impromptu news conferences, as in his explanation of tax compromise with the Republicans. You use literary devices of analysis, like, where's this voice coming from? At one moment, he sounds like a head coach or a football commentator or an ex-champion, as well as taking the words apart. What do you hear in the, shall we say, unscripted Obama?
Yeah, I mean, in the moment that I dwelt on longest, even though it was an improvised moment, I think, in an exchange with an audience in this latest campaign, somewhere in October, I think, 2010, the midterm campaign, Obama had talked about taxes and tried to be very understanding toward the Tea Partiers and other sort of anti-tax fanatics, and said something like, that's in our DNA, right? I mean, folks were oppressing other folks, and so we revolted against it.
Back in the 18th century.
Yeah, but this word, you know, this very unspecifying, very attempted popular stroke of a word like folks, it was way overused in politics, but I think Obama uses it more unnecessarily than anyone in order to try to seem folksy. You know, what was he trying to say? He was trying to talk about George III, the tyranny of Britain in the colonial days, and taxation without representation. Those are specific names and references every literate American would have recognized, but Obama doesn't descend into them, or rather doesn't ascend to them, even though it's ascending to an ordinary middle level. He was in a mood of talking very vaguely, as if he were talking to rather primitive and silly and uninformed people. And, you know, I mentioned there in that same passage that he has another idiom or a higher register, which is rather technocratic, where he'll talk about for instance, on the healthcare bill, the need to prioritize and incentivize and watch the trend lines and so on. So these are two very different idioms. I think the technocratic one is Obama's natural speaking manner for most of the time, most of the day in his presidency, because those are the people he's around. He learned to talk in the surroundings of the legal academy, corporate life, and around bankers and technocrats. And he really, I think, on an honest day, would say he's one of them.
You caught my attention many months ago just with the observation that he sounds like the president of the Ford Foundation or something, a vaguely anonymous boardroom voice, an intelligent mind among a lot of intelligent minds,
right,
sort of representing some kind of anonymous consensus,
right,
of the good people.
Yeah, that's sort of the good and competent elite who are meant to run things. I called him a Fabian non-socialist for that reason. The Fabians believed in the reform of society by a group of technocrats from above in the direction of equality, but not done with any consultation of the populace. And there's nothing at all low about Obama. There's nothing in the least bit vulgar or ill-bred. In fact, if he had just a dash of vulgarity, it might increase the democratic quality of his charm. Nothing low at all about him. He comes from the kind of circle I've just described, academic and so on. I mean, when he talks about, for example, it was in his response to critics of his capitulation on taxes to the Republicans on this latest so-called compromise, where the Bush tax cuts are going to be carried forward for the very rich, even for another 2 years. He said that people underestimate his performance and that the health care bill was a piece of signature legislation. You know, that phrase caught my ear. It's the sort of phrase that would be put into a write-up on the recipient of an honorary degree in a law school or university. I can't describe one of my essays as a signature piece of work. That's for my biographer to do. And in fact, of course, the healthcare bill was anything but a signature piece of legislation. It worked through many committees, delayed by Max Baucus in that search for bipartisan consensus for months, delayed by Obama's own personal wait for Olympia Snow, who never came across, and so on. If he had a signature, we don't know what it looked like. But he was, in effect, praising himself, and there was a sort of unconscious egotism that came through there. And yet I think for him, it was just one more exertion of this neutral, you know, rather impersonal vocabulary that he's very used to and that you read on the blurbs of semi-thoughtful bestsellers.
What can you tell about a man from his language? And second question, who are you comparing him with?
You can only tell much about someone's language as an expression of thought and character if it is someone who has spent a good deal of conscious care on his language. But Obama is such a person. I think one would recognize him as such a person, even if he hadn't told us so quite often. So, you know, in the case of a proficient speaker and an ambitious writer like Barack Obama, or even an expert politician like Bill Clinton, their way of speaking tells you, I'd say, more about them than anything except their actions, and you learn most by comparing their speaking with their actions. What was your second question? I've forgotten it.
Who are you comparing him with?
Oh, well, he compares himself with Lincoln, but I don't think the comparison holds much. He has bits of phrases from Lincoln where Lincoln spoke about the unalienable rights of the Declaration of Independence to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that the proposition, as Lincoln called it, that all men are created equal. He laid down a logical and propositional form by which people could judge his own aspirations and fulfillment of them as a politician and as a leader. Obama, in a similar way, but characteristically using a much vaguer phrase, has talked again and again about his striving to help us form a more perfect union, in order to form a more perfect union. So, you know, you get that kind of thing, and there's often echoes of the second inaugural and of the Gettysburg Address in Obama's speaking, rather casual echoes. The problem is he's not leading the country in a necessary just war, in a civil war against slavery. He hasn't won the kind of victories Lincoln had to win in order to earn those locutions. So Lincoln's rather an inappropriate model. He spoke during the primaries of his admiration for Ronald Reagan as someone who knew how to get across to the American people and knew how to make us feel all one. And though that connection has since been disavowed by some of Obama's spokesmen and handlers, I think it was sincerely meant. I take it that Obama admired Reagan as a persuasive president without any regard to the quality of judgment or the political direction in which Reagan took the country. And that's very interesting that Obama would be able to admire someone's efficiency with words in the abstract. I think that tells you a good deal about Obama, that admiration for Reagan. I also think in a more obvious way, both he and Michelle Obama look back to the Kennedys.
What's the difference for you between Obama speak and JFK?
Well, I've been listening recently to what I can find of JFK's press conferences, more the later ones from 1962 and 63 when he had developed some as a president. The thing that most people talk about when they refer to his proficiency is his mastery of the press, his wit, his ease, his humor, how well he handled people, as if it were all a pragmatic matter of guiding things his way. But what I find when I listen to his press conference, especially one from August 1963, right before the Martin Luther King March on Washington, but others too, including his very last press conference, is Kennedy is often unhappy, displeased with the political situation he is able to command, even irritable. But he has great continuity of thought and mastery, sharp mastery of detail. He is as specific as it is possible to be. He's sometimes spontaneous, and sometimes the spontaneity comes out in the form of jokes, but that's actually rather a rare phenomenon. I would describe Kennedy as leader-like, masterly, but full of human moods and quirks. There is something rather overall unscripted about his performances, but at the same time, one knows that he's come into the press conferences prepared. He also can speak rapidly, as we all do when something's in our mind and we're concerned to say what we really think. One of the noticeable phenomena about Obama in this sort of public performance is how very slowly, how very deliberately, and even fairly often, how brokenly he speaks. And it is not from any lack of linguistic skill, but I think lack of contact between him and what he really wants people to be able to hear of him. So as I hear him, he's not at all the kind of ad-lib performer we had hoped him to be as a leader, and he does not seem to like exchanges. He doesn't seem to like talking to the press with unrehearsed questions. He much prefers the more scripted format of town hall meetings or talk shows.
That human mood and quirk you speak about in the Kennedy, in JFK's every utterance is fascinating to me. I feel, too, that gap with something in JFK, and it's not just the wit. It's, if anything, it's the kind of self-revelation of pain. When Kennedy said in a news conference, life is unfair, I mean, you knew he was thinking of men who had died in the Pacific.
Yeah.
And when he spoke of his Charlie Bartlett, his friend who'd written indiscreetly against Adlai Stevenson in the Saturday Evening Post, and he said, with a bit of a sneer, old friends are best, like, don't come between me and Charlie Bartlett. There was a revelation of anger, of heart, of hurt, or something, and I think we're all still looking for that.
Yep.
When Obama stands up.
Again, a JFK press conference where something like this came out in 62, I believe it was, after the steel manufacturers had violated a tacit agreement between the president, the unions, and the manufacturers and raised their prices almost uniformly. Kennedy was almost beyond irritation, but didn't come forward to denounce them, just showed that he thought they had become very small in his eyes and in the eyes of the nation. He referred to the way they all swarmed into these greedy price-raising fixes as a parade. We didn't know how fast they would join the parade, and the irritation came out that way. Now, you might take that as a moment comparable to the opportunity that Barack Obama had when the bankers and money firms gave out their bonuses. Very comparable moment. But from Obama at that moment, there was silence. Then as denunciations came from popular quarters, both on the right and on the left, his handlers gave the first responses and said, well, no, we don't approve of this, but it's not for us to talk about it. And then very belatedly, Obama said something stiff and rehearsed like, yeah, I'm not one of the fat cats. And by doing that, alienated the bankers whom he had been siding with and whom he had been taking advisors to consult with, and did it without any real reward at all. So there's a kind of all things, awkwardness about this physically graceful and extremely calculating politician.
You conclude from so many readings that President Obama sees it as his role to stand at the convergence of events and help things go the way they're going.
Well, I think now, after the midterm defeat, now he thinks of himself as the person through whom the forces, whatever they are, should just flow. And I think he's become quite visibly now a trimmer in his strategy, going this way and that in order to advance the country in some semi-consistent direction, but not necessarily the one he would have wanted. He hasn't come out post-election, nor will we see him come out on any fixed principle that he would refuse to violate on any terms. That seemed to be possible to his political nature in his first year in office, but it will turn out not to be in his last 2 years of this term. What he did in the first months of his presidency was lay down any number of pledges, what the British call earnests, of his good intentions about Guantanamo, about Israel and Palestine, about nuclear proliferation, about the environment, and you can go on. It was a wonderful list, and he made pretty good but very general speeches on all of them. I believe he supposed, semi-magically, that from the inspiring force of his speeches, a groundswell of support would arise from the bottom that made him do it. There's something fantastic, something delusive, and something unreal about that idea of Israel.
David Brumbidge, it just fascinates me that you've taken politics basically into the English class room and tried to decipher it by the words themselves, the order of the words, the shape of the words, the sound, the rhythm of the words, the consistency of the words.
You go too far.
No, but is this not sort of close reading, as in poetry class?
Yeah, I think any piece of language, again, when it's being spoken by someone who is trying hard to mean what he says and has the power and has had the time to mean what he says, any piece, you know, any stretch of language is worth that kind of analysis and tells you something. But, I mean, in the case of Obama, I think, Chris, you over-subtilized me and presented as something a little more occult than I mean it to be or than I think it is.
Well, I'm just wondering why it works, to my mind, much better than, say, James Kloppenberg's admirable effort to read Obama through his own education.
Yeah.
I mean, through Obama's education as a law student in the philosophy of John Rawls or the philosophical, pragmatic tradition of William James and others, I don't think that reveals as much as this mix of impromptu self-revelation, buzzwords, boilerplate,
yeah,
stuff, the very words that come out of a president's mouth.
Yeah. Well, I consider my method, if it's a method, just, you know, doing the work of a journalist or novelist of everyday life. So it's judgments of character and aspects of character, the way they show in gestures, sometimes in phrases, sometimes in the order of actions that interest me. I read James Kloppenberg's book. I respect his work as an intellectual historian very much. But I think that book just got on the wrong track by over-intellectualizing Obama, by overrating Obama's interest in philosophy and the philosophy of law, and by, you know, overreading the consistency of Obama's commitments in this way or that. I don't happen to believe that when someone is editor of a law review, every article he prints bears the mark of something about his intellectual personality. And I also don't think that Obama is, to so very great an extent, a man of ideas. Few people are, and very few presidents have been. Kennedy wasn't. Lincoln, in a curious sense, was, but that would take another explanation. They were a few ideas. They were very marked, and he had thought them through right to the bottom. He was the most searching of our thinkers among the presidents. But Obama is an intelligent man who's had a privileged and very thorough education, and he's read writers like Reinhold Niebuhr, I think not without as deep an effect as it might have had. He's read thinkers like William James and, you know, the critical legal theorists, no doubt also. But I think too much can be made of it. Once a politician gets into that corporate and technocratic world where decisions are made, you know, what moral man and immoral society meant to him or what Rawls's theory of justice meant to him is a very conjectural and speculative matter with almost no pragmatic influence.
David Brumbidge, unfold some of these judgments that you do draw about the man and his character at different levels. You've written now that he craves legitimacy in a conspicuous form, that he loves fame, that he's curiously dissociated.
Yeah.
How do you get there?
I said all that. I think those are only slightly sharper pieces of phrasing that capture observations lots of people have made. Obama is a celebrity, is the number one celebrity in the United States and perhaps the world, and he is because he wanted to be. Going on more than 1 hour-long talk show, something no previous president has done, and though Obama has claimed it as an act of political necessity, I think one would have to be a silly person to believe that for a moment. He likes that exposure. There's nothing unusual about that. Bill Clinton, JFK, even in his bizarre way, Nixon courted celebrity and loved to be seen. The desire for acceptance, I think, is unusual in Obama, the amount of it. It's most reminiscent for me of Clinton. In Clinton's case, perhaps it goes back to being a white liberal in the South and also to being somebody that, highfalutin people would have thought of as white trash in the South. And then he goes to Georgetown and then he goes to Oxford and meets all the highest of the high. Bill Clinton's need for acceptance, I think, sort of radiates outward from his story, from that Bill Moranis biography and many other accounts one can get. And Obama, I think it's inseparable from the fact that he's the first black president and that on his way up, he was a black person who got a lot of success and for whom a lot of doors opened. But who needed to feel that he was putting people at ease. Well, there are limits to how far one ought to go in putting people at ease if one wants to be an effective and principled politician. And of course, there are matters of character, inseparable matters of character, not just color, involved in this. But when I saw Gary Wills in a short article who was bitter about Obama's capitulation to the generals on Afghanistan, and who I think he was using that article to sign off any commitment of his own to Obama, and said that Obama's strategy was omni-placation. That's pretty much what I meant by craving for acceptance. I like Wills's phrase just as well, but I'm not sure that craving for acceptance doesn't give you at least a sharper picture.
It seems to me your critique is original, not least because you're more careful. And you're courtlier in your inquiries about Obama and into this large subject I'd like to broach of, shall we say, disappointment in Obama. And it obviously is painful to you, as it is painful to all sorts of people. And I think on all sides of the spectrum. Describe this letdown that I think the whole world is going through, perhaps starting with American liberals, but I think it's a general deflation.
Yeah, no, it's happened elsewhere in the world, and we can see the signs of it. It's happened in Turkey and Brazil and Israel, people in whom hopes were raised, preeminently by Obama's Cairo speech, which was not followed up by any concerted Middle East strategy, but also by his talk about the environment, by cap and trade and so on, his failure to be a leader in world environmental discussions. I think disappointment is the right word. That is, Barack Obama, by the hopes he raised, and he was not a man for understatement. I was just looking up the precise words of his June 2008 speech at the end of the primaries, his St. Paul, Minnesota speech, where he said to his followers that maybe we'll look back and say, this was the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow and the planet began to heal. Now, that is exorbitant, and it seems to come out of Genesis. It would be exorbitant language as spoken by one of the peasants in For Whom the Bell Tolls or by Hemingway's hero in The Old Man and the Sea. So, you know, Obama did raise these high expectations, but also seemed to have a realistic grasp of what could be done in politics. I think he overestimated his own skill at politics, and by bringing in so many people who were centrist and conventional, both as fiscal and economic advisors and in the foreign policy establishment and even to some extent in domestic policy, Eric Holder is not a strong attorney general in the sense of restoring the rule of law after Guantanamo and the torture lawyers. There have been no prosecutions of a single banker or of a single person charged with war crimes under the Geneva Convention, which we violated in Guantanamo and elsewhere. So, I mean, he chose people who were very moderate, very much having the complexion of centrists and even time servers who would not disturb too much. Hillary Clinton may prove to be a partial exception to this. Her speech at the Brookings Institution on the Middle East just the other day is the strongest statement by anyone in the administration about Israel and Palestine. It's much stronger than anything Biden or Obama has said. But certainly she was to the right of Obama in foreign policy and a surprising choice even at that time. So he made an appointment, as it were, with the people who cared about him and even the people who were opposed to him, and he has not kept the appointment. He is, in that sense, literally disappointing. But, you know, you will hear excited, enthusiastic, continuing followers of his reply to a statement like that by saying he's done everything he could. What do you mean? The health care bill was a piece of signature legislation. It gave the Democrats what they'd been looking for 50 years. Well, not exactly, but it did something. And no doubt Obama did try to do many things. And he was dealing with a Republican opposition of a intransigence and almost anti-constitutional indifference to the order of politics that has no precedent except in the Clinton years. Obama could have learned something from the Clinton years.
Like what?
He could have learned that it was not a case of just what he called in the primaries partisan bickering of the 90s. It was a case of the Republicans assuming for the first time this stance of saying no to everything, of being willing, for example, to close down government. My theory is Obama did not study or even follow politics very closely in the 1990s. He was ambitious and he was worried about other things. But, I mean, of all the things he said, I was a supporter of Obama, not Hillary Clinton, in the primaries. But of all the things he said at that time, I thought that was the most curious and unfair that the Clintons had been part of merely the partisan bickering of those years. So to your point of, and I'm glad you say it, I'm not sure everyone would, but you know that I seem fair, not hostile, and to be saying things that are minimal and dry about Obama, well, that's certainly what I aim for. And I think disappointed would be a fair description of how I feel. I don't feel any animosity towards him. I still have hope, but the hope has slenderer grounds as one sees his character develop in politics. I don't think we have any alternative right now from my point of view.
Is the hope in him? Is it the hope in somebody else? Is it the hope in some dawning awareness among people like you or me?
Well,
Where does it go?
We should say we're talking on December 15th, 2010, and I think right now nothing is more important in the mind of Barack Obama than re-election in 2012. And I will be very pleasantly surprised if we see moves by him in foreign or domestic policy that indicate some other aim than triangulating and trimming towards a victorious result in the election of 2012. That seems to me what his mind is on. One's hope is that whatever, through an experience of conversion or something, he decides that there is another thing more important than that after all. But I guess I meant hope more broadly, that while the Democrats hold the White House and while they hold one house of the Congress, somehow there could be a turn away from the obstructionist and imperialist politics that this country has been following for so many years. But that hope, I think, to the extent that it's connected with the Democrats, is going to have to come from a leader who is not Obama, because on the evidence, he does not particularly see himself as a leader. And I think he does not lead. He makes inspiring speeches from the top. He sends his people in to negotiate, and he is happy for the signature result. But that's very different from what one could see, for example, John Kennedy doing on the Test Ban Treaty or Lyndon Johnson doing on the civil rights legislation. Leadership in that sense of the word we have not seen, and I think it may be far from his grasp.
David Brumwich, you are, among other things, a scholar of Edmund Burke, the British statesman of the 18th century. I'm fascinated by a Burke line that you've quoted, that a true politician always considers how he shall make the most of the existing materials of his country. I wondered a little guiltily sometimes to myself if this is a line of Obama defense, that he's working with what he's got.
Yeah, The Burke who speaks of a disposition to preserve and an ability to improve as his standard of a statesman, and says that anything else is vulgar in the conception and perilous in the execution. That seems to go with the pragmatic and moderate stance that Obama cultivates, and cultivates increasingly, but it is much in line with his temperament. The belief in slow change, and slow change using the materials that you already have. Burke says that, or things like it, in many places. He says it in his speech on conciliation with America. He says it in a more drastic series of formulations in Reflections on the Revolution in France. Burke also, and not incidentally, believed in the good of party politics as essential to constitutional and representative government. And the reason, Burke thought, was that by party, as a form of legitimate association and expressed loyalty, people showed themselves and showed each other what their convictions amounted to, so that there was no contradiction between a desire to be candid with the public and tell the truth and party loyalty. A party had a platform and you went with it for what it was worth. Bipartisanship, Burke would have thought, was a sort of hermaphroditic aspiration. It's wanting to be all things to all people. It is, if you will, omniplacatory. And he had no liking for it any more than he had a liking for neutrality in the war between the French revolutionists and the defenders of British liberty in the 1790s. I mean, in an odd way, Burke, and it comes out in those later writings, prefers the Jacobins because at least you know where to have them. They believe in something, to people who affect a sort of being above party, being above politics. I'm afraid that Obama risks seeming not only without loyalty to his party, but a kind of dilettante in politics by the attitude he more and more affects of disdain and a sort of distaste for party loyalty. And one has been seeing no longer between the lines, but again, more and more for quotation, even in the New York Times, expressions of extreme discontent with this attitude of his, sometimes called an attitude of the White House, by Democrats in the House of Representatives and in the Senate. They felt that the White House let them down by failing to offer guidance and very opportunistically declining to offer guidance on cap and trade. They also felt it in the later stages on health care, and if the accounts I have heard can be believed, it was Nancy Pelosi who put backbone into Obama at the very last stages and, you know, pulled out the health care bill. But party loyalty and consistency to a set of principles can absolutely be consistent with what Burke speaks of as a non-fanatical willingness to use the materials a society already offers, not to start the revolution tomorrow and start it as if from the year zero. Nobody in America, nobody who's ever been a leader of this country, nobody of all our presidents has ever come within hailing distance of trying to start things in that revolutionary way from year zero. Nobody except maybe Tom Paine, of our great men, has even come close to recommending it.
In terms of the existing conditions of the country, I'm also thinking just simply, what if he says, hey, we've got an enormously powerful financial sector in this country, and I'm just dealing with it. We've got an enormously powerful Israel lobby,
yeah,
and I'm dealing with it. We've got a long history of military adventure, long before me, and I'm just working with it.
Yes. That would be candid in the 18th century sense of the word, which means combining honesty with a kind disposition towards your audience and those who might, you might be thought to criticize. That's correct. The Israel lobby names a fact. The big banks and money firms and their enormous influence names a fact. The defense establishment names a fact. Obama is very reluctant to call any of these things by their names. He speaks in euphemism. He speaks in roundabout ways, and he acts as if he agrees with them and disagrees with them. Mm. He will go along with the big bonuses from the bankers and then denounce them as fat cats. And in that way, get the worst of both worlds, because he alienates the very people his policy is going along with, and he doesn't even reap the benefit of having the great powers on his side. They are, so to speak, pragmatically on his side, but affectively, they become very displeased with him. They don't want to have the negative reputation he's endowing them with. And this, again, connects back for me with his extraordinary estimate of the, I called it in one place, omnipotence of words, as if words could do everything. It's words matched with actions that give the unique opportunity to a leader of a great country like the United States. And if Obama's words in Cairo, for example, had been made commensurate with any subsequent course of action, the world would be looking up now. He stepped forward and stepped back on that. He actually, you know, showed Benjamin Netanyahu that the United States was put out of countenance by the Israeli settlements. But he's never used the phrase settler movement to name an Israeli reality that even many Israelis don't sympathize with. It took Hillary Clinton the other day to name that. Barack Obama has very rarely used the word occupation, which names a reality, and a reality that's illegal under international law. It took Hillary Clinton the other day to reiterate that. So this is, I think, dispositional. It's temperamental. It's not always an on-purpose decision. But he, again, the contrast I make most strongly is with John Kennedy. He does not name things by their precise names. There is a want of precision and address in the way he speaks. Reagan's much more comparable. Reagan had this kind of inexactness and imprecision and vaguely inspirational quality. And the disappointment there is that Obama has so much more mind than Ronald Reagan. Mm. But the results are looking rhetorically rather similar, so that Obama's no more educating us to the nature of our Constitution or our fortunes than Ronald Reagan did.
Very little irony in Obama. No sense of that Kennedy tragic struggle.
I think Obama has the detachment of an ironist, and I suspect that in person, to the people he trusts, he may be very capable of irony. He doesn't have a sense of humor. That's flat, and that's.
But he makes jokes. You're one of the few people who called him on a line before the White House correspondence in which he said he was speaking about keeping his daughters safe, and he said two words: predator drones. How much can you read from a so-called joke?
I read a lot. He's the most powerful man in the world. He is assassinating people with predator drones. Many civilians are dying. You don't turn that into a joke. It shows a want of self-restraint. It shows a lack of imagination. To do it for a laugh was reminiscent of George W. Bush. And the other people who have noticed this, picked it out, have compared it to the comical snapshots of George Bush searching under his chair, under his desk, behind the furniture in the White House for the weapons of mass destruction, and showing how funny he thought it was that there were no weapons of mass destruction to be found. I think the two are exactly comparable. I think they're the same failure of feeling in Obama in that moment in front of the White House press corps that there was in Bush. And I better not say any more about that because I'm going to feel too strongly.
David Brumwich, I'm just puzzling. It's a bad time for journalism, journalism companies, journalism's audiences. And politics, maybe for that reason, is less and less an argument about verifiable facts, about the actual course of the war in Afghanistan, or, say, the fate of American families in a very bad recession, yep, more and more being put out of houses every day. What's the way back to a more, shall we say, reality-based, fact-based political discourse?
Well, I found my way back to feeling that I lived in a country where there was free discussion by reading various sites on the internet and watching Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! And going to various other sources that are available. I think that there's been a disastrous failure in the mainstream media, which we can date back to 2002, 2003, and the government lies that they fed into American opinion at that time. But I think it goes back further than that. And yet I have to admit, I'm so conventional or whatever, that my only solution is a conventional one, that I think if there's going to be a general return to a higher level of awareness of the facts among American citizens, it's going to have to come through people like journalists and national leaders, journalists with a wide readership, and national leaders who can reach a lot of people, such as, for example, the leaders of a party. A speech like Bernie Sanders's remarkable 8.5-hour performance the other night against the renewal of the Bush tax cuts for the rich was so full of information, including information, for example, about the disclosures by Ben Bernanke of the Fed loans to the banks and money firms that go into the trillions, into many trillions, out of the Treasury of the United States to keep these banks going and to renew and enhance their power. That was a deeply educational speech. And if Bernie Sanders had the eminence that he deserves to have, I can't say in his party because he's an independent, but on the national stage, that speech would have made an enormous impact. So it's a matter of noticing what's there, but also of a party like, say, the Democratic Party, putting forward the people who are capable of leading and forming opinions and letting them have a larger role. But I don't see any way back, if you want to call it a way back, outside that. Now, as to the information we're getting about Afghanistan, atrocities in Iraq and Afghanistan, and so on, look at the case of WikiLeaks. It makes more available than was ever close to hand for us before. But the very quantity of the materials and the immediacy of people having opinions about the materials, should the newspapers have published them at all? What do you think of Julian Assange? Should he be assassinated or is he a hero? It all diverges into this kind of argument. And the numbers of people, and I include myself as partly culpable here, I have not read many of the documents. I've only read those on Pakistan. But the number of people who have read quite a lot of the available documents from this last WikiLeaks set of disclosures is small compared to the number who think that they have that case all solved. So what we've got now is and it's partly because of the phenomena of the internet, an enormous gap between the availability of accurate information as well as the availability of opinions well-supported and not well-supported, and the lack of consensus on where you should go to get the best information and how you should digest it.
Or even, as they say in the news business, where's the lead? I think the lead is, in many documents, a kind of consensus among the professionals, spooks and diplomats and folk, that this war in Afghanistan is a cul-de-sac. It's over. It's not working. We haven't got the right people or the right terrain or anything. I'm not sure that has yet been the lead in the New York Times, although it was the lead today that our own CIA establishment is saying pretty much that.
The intelligence establishment saying something different from what the military put out. But, you know, if you read an account like Bob Woodward's of the debates over the Afghanistan Review of 2009, you discover even then, you know, the president's decision to go along with the three main generals, Petraeus, whose reputation was on the line at that war, McChrystal, and Mike Mullen, who's Navy Admiral and really has no sort of contact with that sort of land war. You know, Obama had extraordinary support against that view by the generals. He had on his side Ambassador Eikenberry, also a former general, and somebody who was ahead of Petraeus and McChrystal at West Point, and to whom they looked up. He had Eikenberry in these cables, which were made semi-public. He had a guy named Douglas Lute, Bush's war czar. Bush's war czar was against expansion of the Afghanistan commitment. John Brennan, the counterterrorism expert, Biden, and to a lesser extent, President Obama had on his side General Jim Jones, his national security advisor, and General Cartwright, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And with all that, and with that opportunity, he still chose what he thought the path of least resistance and of inevitable slow forward motion to go further into Afghanistan. Now, that is the path probably most people would have taken who succeeded to George W. Bush. But if you are imaginative and if you see what a political opportunity is, it's hard to imagine a better one than that at that moment for Obama to have made a declaration to the American people that we must begin to reconsider now. He also had, incidentally, Colin Powell on his side.
We don't do mountains after all.
We don't do mountains after all.
David Brumage, I don't know what to make of it exactly, that the most interesting commentary on Barack Obama comes from literary people. You and Zadie Smith are my favorites, as opposed to political people. And I don't mean to give you the job of political inspiration or leadership or policymaking either, but just for plain incisive insight into character and the direction of things, I think you do remarkable work. I'm hugely grateful for what I read from you wherever, especially in the London Review of Books, and I'm very grateful for this conversation. Thank you.
Thanks.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.